your baby boy would save our sons and daughters. Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new? This child that you delivered will soon deliver you.
Hello, this is Joseph Barley Presents. I'm Diana White Eagle, co-producer, and assisting is Ned Matania. The call-in number is 323-744-4831. And we are dedicating this show to Stella, Joseph's better half, who is in the hospital with mending bones and COVID. So Joseph will probably not be here tonight. But we have some exciting guests. Our first guest is Louisa Peck, who is someone who was a diehard atheist and had a near-death experience, and it changed her life. And we're also going to talk about her book. It's available. It's on her near-death experience. And so, welcome, Louisa.
Hi, it's good to be here.
And what would you like to start with?
Well, if you like, I can dive right into my NDE.
Yes.
Because really, my NDE did not change my life.
Oh, okay. I did it wrong then.
No, it's not that. For most NDEers, it definitely does. But in my case, I was, well, I'll just tell the story and then it will make sense to you why I rejected it. I guess I can say before my NDE experience, My father, who had a big resentment against religion, had pretty much indoctrinated me with atheism and secularism and just, yeah, contempt for anything that wasn't scientific. And so, I mean, or at least I guess we have to say traditional science, Newtonian science, because it's all science, right? But in any case, I had just graduated from Vassar College, and I had moved to New York City because I sort of didn't know what to do with myself. And it seemed, you know, if I can make it here, I'll make it anywhere type thing. And I also, you know, my God at that time was coolness. I wanted to be cool at 22 years old. And it seemed to me that the nightclubs in Manhattan were kind of the mecca for coolness, at least in my mind, in the early 80s. This was 1982. That's what seemed to be the sort of most Deborah Harry, Pat Benatar place to be. So I went to a nightclub with a friend who was also a coke dealer. We did a lot of cocaine on our way there. We did more cocaine in the nightclub, and it was a really cool nightclub called the Peppermint Lounge in Greenwich Village. And I really felt like I am so cool now. I found the coolest nightclub. Everything's going great. And we were dancing, and it was all new wave. And all of a sudden, we ran out of cocaine, and I started coming down to just kind of ordinary life. And I wasn't having that. So I, my date and I pooled whatever cash we had. And I had a lot of cash because I was a bus girl at a Columbia Avenue restaurant. And, so we bought what we were told was cocaine, and we rubbed it on our gums and it numbed our gums. And so we gave him the money, and he gave us a gram, and he vanished. And we both tried it. And my date said, "This is junk. This is doing nothing." And he threw down his bill that he was using as a straw. And I just had the thought, well, it did numb our gums, so don't want to waste it. Like, maybe that's how I am with food, too, right? I thought, if I snort the whole pile, maybe I'll just get a little bit high. So I did snort the whole pile. And unbeknownst to me, was not cocaine at all. It was lidocaine. I wouldn't learn this for quite a few years until I got sober and made friends with a number of reformed drug dealers. And they told me it was very normal to cut cocaine with lidocaine because lidocaine is so much cheaper when you're selling it. But sounds like what I was told was just pure lidocaine. And lidocaine is an anesthetic. And it'll shut down your nervous system, and it stopped my heart. So it didn't do it suddenly. It did it slowly. So I went to go use the restroom and began to develop tunnel vision on the way there. And I just thought, wow, this is such a cool side effect of cocaine that I've never had before, and nobody's told me about it before. It didn't occur to me that I had snorted something else. And then in the restroom, I found that it was starting to seem dark. I couldn't read any of the graffiti, and I felt like there was no air. I felt like the air was all breathed up. The reason for that was that my heart rate was going slower and slower and slower under the lidocaine poisoning, and probably, you know, maybe down to 30 beats a minute, so my brain was not getting enough oxygen. So I made it out, and I found my friend. And he said, let's get you some water from the bar. And the bartender gave me a glass of water, which I did not want. I was saying, there's no air in here. There's no air in here. And I was starting to get angry, which is kind of a symptom of oxygen starvation. I was so frustrated that nobody else could tell there was no air down there, it seemed to me, because this nightclub floor was in the basement. And so I took the glass of water and I took a sip, and then what happened on this side was that I fell over backwards, had a grand mal seizure and a cardiac arrest. And what happened on my side was I felt like something hit me under the chin. Kind of like a Popeye punch is how I describe it. I thought for a second that I had collapsed and hit my chin on the bar because it seemed like such a violent blow. But it shot me up in the air like I'd been fired out of cannon, and I had this utter delight that I was just shooting straight up, and I felt the ground in Manhattan and everything kind of recede away below me, and all I felt was just this delight, and I felt like, thank goodness, all that nonsense is over. And by all that nonsense, I meant my whole life as Louisa. I just felt free of it, wanted nothing to do with it. It just seemed really like a silly enterprise. And so I shot straight up into the air with beautiful blue sky. I felt completely free and happy, and I had a thought that I would do a back bend and do kind of a swan dive backwards, and I did it, and it worked. And this is when I was slowing at the top of my trajectory, and I was diving towards the ocean. The ocean went from one horizon to the other, and it was perfectly blue, and I had the thought, if you hit the ocean, if you hit the water, surface of the water from this high at this speed, isn't it like concrete, kind of? And I didn't feel afraid. I just felt like, well, we'll find out. And so I dove into the water, perfect dive, which is not very much like me, but it worked on the other side, and went straight down. And I was like, that worked out. And then I saw that the surface was way up above me, to the point where I was kind of afraid about whether I could reach it. But again, I didn't feel fear. I just felt wondering, like, that's pretty far away. How am I going to swim up to that? And then the next thing I know, I've come up to the surface, and I can see the beach that wasn't there before, but now it is. It's not so far off. And I decide to swim to it, but I really only have to swim one stroke, and then I'm wading out of the waves. And I just felt like, well, that worked out. That was great. And I looked down the beach, which was not a tropical beach. It was more like a northwest beach. It was kind of rocky. And there was a mesa down the beach to my left as I faced away from the water. And up on top of that mesa, I saw an old weather-beaten house. It was pale blue and not really dilapidated, but very weathered. And I just knew that has to do with me. That house has to do with me. I want to be there. So instantly, I was not at the house. Instantly, I was at the bottom of that mesa, which had kind of turned into a big pile of boulders that I had to climb. And they were covered with this putrid green stuff. My thought was, this is just disgusting. And I wondered if it was rotten seaweed or what it was, but I also was very determined to get to the house, so I just felt like I can do this, and I climbed the rocks. But when I reached the house, I was at the door sill, and I had somehow lost my body. So I was just an inch above the door sill, and I was nothing but a sort of subjective camera. There was no body, and I was just above the floor. I went over the door sill. As soon as I was in the house, I understood it was the house of my ancestors, and I could feel all my ancestors' presence, and I intuited that we had all passed through this house, and now it was my turn. And I felt all this honor and love. And as a 22-year-old, I didn't even really know who my ancestors were. I didn't care. I had no interest in that kind of thing. But on the other side, it meant everything to me. I felt just really proud to be in their presence. And I couldn't see them, but I could feel them. And I could feel in particular my father's father, who died before I was born, never got to meet me. And he was really happy that he was going to meet me. So with all this anticipation, I also felt like, hey, there's something wrong here. There's supposed to be an armchair that faces this picture window that looks out at the ocean, and it's not here. And I had this feeling like that's not fair. Like I've been chipped. Where's the armchair? But also I was too low to, even if there had been one, to get up in an armchair. I was still only an inch off the ground. And so I thought, everybody loved to sit in the chair and look at the beautiful view. How am I? I want to see it. And as soon as I thought, I want to see it, something else took control and pulled me by my sternum, even though I didn't have a body, but it felt like my heart space, pulled me forward across the floor. I could see the floor with so much detail, but I was traveling over it, and I had this feeling like, whoa, this kind of motion, unexpected motion. And then I went up the wall and over the windowsill and out, and I was flying over the ocean, and I was zooming straight for the sun. And excuse me, I have a little sip of tea here.
Oh my goodness.
Well, the sun was casting a path across the ocean. Absolutely beautiful. It was setting. The sky was illuminated with all these gorgeous colors. And that's when my little skeptics kind of piped up, because I was zooming forward and it felt so delicious and wonderful. But then I thought, this is like almost too perfect. Wait a minute. People can't fly. You know, this must be a dream. Is this real? And as soon as I asked, is this real? I felt a voice. People call it, you know, thought speak, but it wasn't just in my thoughts. It really did feel like it was all around me and with me. And it said, more real than anything back there. And it was a very powerful voice, and I felt its wisdom. And I had certainly not expected anyone to answer my wondering. We don't expect anybody to answer when we wonder something. But when he said that, well, I didn't think of it as a he yet, but when the voice said that, I thought, yeah, this is true. This is more real. I can tell this is more real. I'm more alive. I'm more present. Everything is more real. And the sun, meanwhile, was getting bigger and bigger as I was zooming toward it. So again, I had a wondering rather than a fear. Am I going to vaporize? Like, you can't get too close to the sun, and I'm getting awfully close. And then instead of vaporizing, I just kind of passed through this filament, and I was inside the sun. And inside the sun was the light. And it was what all the NDEers try to describe, that love that is just beyond any love you can possibly name here on earth with language. It was huge love. It was powerful love. And it was completely like permeating me, infusing me. It wasn't just something outside me. It was going through me. And it also felt warm. It felt perfect and so good. And I had a sense of finally, because all the kind of vanity that I had been doing back in there in New York, trying to be cool, trying to go to nightclubs, trying to be hip and, you know, nightclub scene, all this crap. It was all trying to feel like I was good enough, because I didn't feel that way. And I finally did. I finally felt loved and complete and like I was lacking nothing. And it was just the most wonderful relief. And then I had a sense that I was being held. I was actually like an infant in the arms of some being that was holding me in its arms, cradling me in its arms, and just pouring love into me. You are so loved. You are so loved. And it was for me specifically, for me, not like we do this for everybody. It knew me and it adored me. And I loved the parent, and I just didn't want any of this to ever end. But then the parent said, you can't stay. You're not done yet. And those were both completely foreign concepts to me. Like, I hadn't even remembered there was any place else to be besides here. So what does stay mean? Like, what are you talking about? And then done yet? I'm not done with what? What does that mean? I didn't understand. And then at the instant that the parent said that, the figure holding me said that, it cut to blackness. And I had a sense of dropping. And I threw a fit of anger. I was going to kick the parent in the shins. I was going to show the parent, you can't kick me out. You can't. I'm going to stay. I'm going to show you who's boss here. And I had a little after message that was just, case closed, sweetheart. It was over. Done deal. Then I felt the dropping. And then I was afraid for just a little second there. And then in the blackness around me, I began to see these white stick figures, kind of like chalk drawings on a blackboard. And they were just little stick figures. And they were children. And they were going on swing sets. And they were playing on teeter totters and merry-go-rounds. And they were saying these silly little rhymes, like how many hippos make a flim flam, or just weird little silly little sayings. And I thought, this is nowhere good as good as the light. And I'm still like, I can't believe I lost the light. But I'm going to just kind of watch this like Saturday morning cartoons. I'm just going to hang out and watch this until I can go back to the light. So that was my plan. But then one of the stick figures got closer, and his little circle head filled in solid like a dinner plate. And I was kind of like, man, I can't see around you. You're blocking my view of the other stick figures. And instead of saying rhymes anymore, he was saying, how many fingers? What is your name? And it was, yeah, in fact, the bartender. And he had been doing CPR on me nonstop for 3 minutes. And I came to on the floor with a huge pile of, crowd of people around me. They had stopped the music. They had stopped everything. The lights were on, and I was in this pool of sweat. And I kind of had the mind of a five-year-old when I came back. And I just thought, oh, wow, this is some kind of big deal. Everybody thinks it's really important. And I felt kind of silly. I felt like giggling. And I didn't understand why I was soaking wet. And then I just went with my date, and we went up the stairs. I just thought, okay, we're going upstairs. I guess we're going upstairs. Whole crowd of gawkers came with us up the stairs. It was like a big crowd of us, and I was just in the middle, and I kind of felt like, well, I guess this is just a thing to do. And we went out on the sidewalk and sat down on a bench against the building, and I started smoking a cigarette, and the bartender came over, and I barely thanked him. He said, you were gone for 3 minutes. And my date said, yeah, you weren't responding at all. You were just gray like a corpse. In fact, I told him to stop. But I regretted all these years that I didn't thank him. I didn't go to the hospital because eventually I asked my date what we were waiting for, and he said, we're waiting for the ambulance. And I said, okay, that's cool. And then I was like, wait a second, who's it for? And he said, for you, you were dead. And so I thought about going to the hospital. I thought about my parents finding out. I thought about them flying out from Seattle. I thought about, I couldn't have that happen. And so I just said, I don't want to go to the hospital. And we jumped in a cab and went back to my apartment. And I'm going to skip ahead. This part of the story is recounting the story to my roommate. And when we got to the part of the parent, she asked me, is that God? Was that God? And I felt all this embarrassment and awkwardness. And I knew it was, but I couldn't say that. Being me, I couldn't say that. And so I just laughed and said, yeah, it was like God or something. And then I went and closed myself in the bedroom alone, and I thought, and I had a journal to write down what had happened. And I knew it had been real. And it seemed to me that if I went ahead and said this was real, I would have to go to church. That was the only thing I could connect with this kind of afterlife. I didn't know anything else. And I thought about myself. I tried to imagine myself kind of recast as this churchy girl. And my God was still coolness. I couldn't give that up. And so I just decided that my brain had shut down from hypoxia, that the reason it had seemed so vivid was because as all the kind of peripheral things going on in one's mind normally shut down, I went to this point where I was just my source itself, which was love. And that's why. And then I thought about, but what about when he said, when it said, no, you can't stay, or, you know, you're not done yet. And I was like, well, never mind about that, you know, or you know, what about the intensity of that love? No, well, never mind. What about when he says more real? No. I'm just going to say it was hypoxia. And that's my story. And it was a brain thing and I'm sticking to it. And, so I meant to do that. And I kept drinking and I got super depressed. And so I saw a ghost and I still said to myself, I'm not going to pay attention to this. And then I knew of a death in the family and I said, I'm not going to pay attention to this. And I feel like, you know, there are many people who get kind of a knock on the door of their consciousness. And they get an opportunity to realize there is more, to realize there is a spiritual dimension, that there is a reality of spirit world that is beyond materialist constructions mm-hmm. that we're taught. And a lot of people bypass it. And I was on course to bypass it. But that's not what my angel was going to let happen. So I had a series of what I call weird things that completely changed my life because they just, the miracles and the voice and the knowings, they just kept coming. And eventually I kind of had to just break and say, all right, I know you're real. I know this is real and I will never doubt again. And that's what the book I wrote is about. It's about getting to that point and then getting to IONS, meeting other NDEers, understanding that I'm just a garden variety NDEer. And then once I knew that what an NDE was, I wasn't afraid to talk to the voice. Then it's kind of like, I don't want to say I have powers, but I will say that I have awarenesses and they began to get stronger. So I wouldn't say I'm a medium, but I've been accidental medium many times and I have weird things that happen all the time. And the latest one was just last week.
Mm. My goodness. That's an adventure, a near-death experience that I have never heard. And I've heard plenty. So this is quite unique, what you experience.
Well, if you think about what was going on, I think that I was passing through different elements. You know, a lot of people talk about ascending to different levels. And for me, I went through air, water, earth, wood, then air again, and then fire.
Mm.
The sun. So it was that. There was also the fact that my father had taught me all my life that the sun was my source, that all the energy on the earth, all the energy in the plants, everything we eat, you know, it originally combusted on the sun. And so that was my source. That was my God. Plus, this is the beauty of nature when I was flying toward it. But I can tell you when I first heard the voice really clearly, so I continued being an alcoholic. So that happened in 1982 when I was 22. And if we fast forward, 12 years, I was living in a log cabin in the country. I was working the barista in Olympia, and I was just drinking, going to parties. I destroyed my
marriage, and then I destroyed the relationship after that with drinking. And I went to a party with a bunch of teenagers. I was 34, with a kegger, and I drank beer till I was falling down drunk. And some friends tried to put me in a house and take away my keys so that I wouldn't drive home, because it was a long drive from downtown Olympia to my house out in the country. But after they left, I got my keys. I somehow found my car, found the ignition, started up, and just felt this kind of and I was so shit-faced. And I drove so just speeding, and I had reached the point in my alcoholism where I just wanted to splatter myself a tree or a telephone pole. I just wanted it to end. I didn't want to live anymore. I felt like I had tried and I just couldn't do it. And everything, so many people I had hurt, so many things that I had destroyed, and I just felt like I don't want this anymore. So I came to a bridge over some railroad tracks where the road got skinny, and the reflectors, I was seeing triple. I don't know how it works that you can see more than double, because I saw so many reflectors. And I just kind of thought, I'm just going to shoot for the middle. And if I hit it and I die, then great. And I shot through, and I was on the other side. And I, not much further there to get to my house. And I got to the log house, and I, got out of the car. I had to hold on to the door because I couldn't stand on my own. And the starry night above me. And my thought was, I drive like such a badass when I'm drunk. That's what I thought. And then something came from the stars and shot through me. And it was a thought voice, but it was more powerful than a thought voice. It was more like getting struck by a lightning bolt of thought. And it said two things. It said, this is the last time I can help you, and you do know right from wrong. And it was kind of pissed.
Oh, yes, I can imagine.
And I knew something big had happened, but I somehow in the morning when I woke up, I was blackout drunk, and I had left this huge mess in the kitchen that I had no recollection of, no memory of, you know, spilling the oatmeal or leaving the milk mm-hmm. out or any of the things I had done. But I could remember that moment with the bridge crystal clear, and I could remember that moment when I got shot with the bolt of thought. And my mm-hmm. feeling now is that spiritual memories are different than brain memories, that my angel is the one who took me across that bridge. My angel is the one who got me home and then said, I'm done. If you want to destroy yourself, if you want to throw away all these gifts that you have, go for it, because I'm done. And that's, I was telling my story once, I think it was Dallas, or I can't remember where it was, but one of the guys said, isn't that one of the principles of Al-Anon? That with an addict at a certain point, you just have to cut them loose and detach with love. Which is
well, what that's
my
the angel did.
So I kept drinking for about another month after that, but I just kept hearing that voice saying, you do know right from wrong. You do know mm-hmm. right from wrong. And I also had the sense that, yeah, I knew someone had been helping me. I knew that. And so I got sober on January 29th, 1995, and I haven't had a drink since.
Good.
And
good for you.
Thanks.
No, really. Your angels say thank you. You were making them ragged.
Yeah. But
now,
then
I was going to ask you, where can we purchase your book?
It's on Amazon, and the title is, what's the title of it? diehard atheist from NDE denier to full-on woo-woo against my will. So diehard atheist from NDE denier to full-on woo-woo, because I am a full-on woo-woo, and I can tell you stories now of things that have happened and things I've known and adventures I've had with my angel, who now has a name. And I'm also, it's just, I have a wonderful life, and I'm so happy and so blessed and so excited about being alive. So, yeah.
It's amazing sometimes how we have to walk through the terrible darkness before we get there. I'm going to say thank you, and we're going to have Ned on. Ned, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, good. Anyway, I know this is an interesting way to follow someone, because your story was something that I've never heard before, and I've heard lots of near-death experiences. But I'm so glad you're here, and I'm so glad that you decided to stay until you're supposed to leave. But if we could have Ned come on and tell us his story, I think we have a totally different take on it, but it's quite interesting. Are you ready?
And we're friends, and we see all of this eye to eye, everything.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes. Well, and I love, you know, even her book title, like, because I used to be an atheist as well, and I love in her case, you know, the diehard atheist. I mean, it's like a pun, and it's literal, and because I also am a skeptic, but I'm open-minded. Like, I love critical thinking. I love science, and I see how important it is, and I try to encourage it in society. But in my own story, you know, almost similar to Louisa, like when I was in high school and whatnot, I thought that atheism, it was the most logical, intelligent answer. And when I had a biology class in high school and I learned about evolution and how everything evolved out of, you know, a single-celled organisms, I thought this seems like an interesting explanation, and it seems like, yeah, everything is kind of an accident. And so in learning all of that, we are never told anything about intuition or soul or anything non-physical. All doubt that you ever are taught is it's these physical cells, and that basically life is physical, and there is no a non-physical thing. It's all an illusion that our brains are creating. And so, if you combine the fact that I was an atheist and a materialist, which materialism is that paradigm of only physical matter exists, which is common in academia and whatnot. If you combine that with the fact that I was extremely depressed and I felt like school was a prison, you know, in middle school and high school, I didn't have a reason for being here either. And even though I didn't turn to alcohol or drugs, I turned to a TV and basically being a couch potato addicted to junk food, fast food, TV, and, you know, no goals or purpose. I felt horrible about myself. I started to get health problems, as is natural if that's all you eat and that's all you do, and that I wasn't sleeping enough. I didn't have any friends. I didn't have a family who I felt nurtured by and seen by. I had an abusive father, and I had a mother who was kind of avoidant in her own world. So I was on my own, you know, and when you're an atheist and you feel like that, you don't have a reason to be here. And I thought about suicide. I thought about, well, there's no point. You know, what's the point anyway? We're, if we all die, you know, there isn't any consequence ultimately. Like everyone alive, if you look on Earth, will eventually die, and it'll just all, like an equation, end up a zero. That's how I saw it. And so I thought about suicide. Like I never reached a point where I was like actively planning it, but I was almost there. Like I thought of it as like a backup plan, because I didn't have a reason. And so I started looking into spirituality, and it started on accident when I learned about astrology, of all things. And it wasn't like a typical horoscope in a magazine. I was on the internet and I saw this long article, as if it was written by ancient philosophers or wise men. And it was like about the signs and about the earth and the universe. And it started making me see life or question life in a new way. But ultimately, through that, I started thinking about people and how we're all different. And if you think about, you know, like Shakespeare and the idea that we're all characters in a play and whatnot, that isn't too different than what a lot of NDEers, they talk about. Like we come here and we have personalities and roles, and sometimes with certain people there's a friction there, but ultimately there's a purpose in learning, and other people it's easy and harmonious and there's a purpose in that. And so astrology was like a doorway to question, is anything like this even real? And I started, this was in high school, I started asking everyone I knew for their birthdays, and kind of like a scientist examining, like, this person is this, you know, has this information, and this person has this, and trying to observe everyone and observe myself. And when I talk about astrology, it isn't only the sun sign, it's the whole chart, which is a whole tangent. But if you think about it, like every person is basically like a walking solar system, because it isn't only your sun sign. You know, if I say I'm a Taurus, everyone, or if a person will say that, what it actually means is that at the time they were born, if you looked at the sun and you looked at the constellation behind it, it would be Taurus. And then, but anyway, the moon and planets and everything all have influences. But after that, I started looking into world religions. And so in college, I took a class on that. And I learned about Eastern religions and Western religions. And I tried to understand like where humanity's perspectives were about all this. And it was interesting, and I did see or learn about like how underneath it all, they all talk about the golden rule, and about like you don't want to hurt others because ultimately it's going to hurt yourself. You don't want to, or you want to help others because it's like helping yourself, and that's a common thread. But fast forward after that, it wasn't until I came across near-death experiences and mediums that I finally felt like here is actual valuable data beyond religion or like old ideas. This is actually relevant, and it's now, and we can, it's in medical records of people. It's in, like I started actually getting psychic and medium readings just out of curiosity, like a scientist, like seeing, what information they were saying, and if there was any possibility of them knowing that, or, you know, compared to random chance and all that. And over time, I realized there is evidence, and there is, like, it is real. And I'll say I eventually became a medium myself because I went through training, but I'll say that we all ultimately have intuition and we all can actually train ourselves. It's almost like a sport or like a skill. You know, if you think about basketball, some people are just naturally gifted at it. Others practice and practice and are okay at it. It's just like that.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until learning about near-death experiences and basically finally finding that reason to live. And so, you know, I was on here the other week and I talked about how I started Facebook's first and largest near-death experiences group. And I started that in September of 2013. And it was a year after I attended my first IANS conference, which is International Association for Near-Death Studies. And if you've heard of Dr. Raymond Moody, I think he was actually one of the founders of it. And I'm a huge fan of IANS and supporter of them because they're basically one of the few or only organizations who actually have credible doctors, researchers, scientists who are taking NDEs seriously and studying them, and also supporting experiencers. So, they have an annual conference, and it's often on Labor Day weekend, and this year it'll be in Phoenix, and I plan on being there, and I'm excited about it.
Oh yeah, that would be quite exciting.
And so ultimately, you know, like at this point, through my NDE group on Facebook, which as of now has about 200,000 members. And there are others out there too that I'm a part of and I support because in my mind, like we're all a family. We're all supporting each other. And that's exactly what experiencers learn on the other side is that oftentimes in our society and culture and egos, we are very individualistic and it's a competition. And it's like, who is winning, you know, whose ego is larger or whatnot. And then when people die, it's like, no. It's like, it's a much bigger picture. It's a much more mature. It's almost like humanity is in the process of maturing and growing. And the ego stage of like a comparing and judging and whatnot is almost like the adolescent stage. And I've heard some experiencers talk about how over time we are evolving and humanity will eventually reach a stage where almost like in Star Trek, we are beyond a lot of the conflicts and bickering and we kind of are all supporting each other and, you know, the earth and a greater purpose, which I find amazing. But yeah, Diana, how am I on time?
Oh, you have 10 minutes, 9 minutes, 9 minutes.
Okay.
You're doing well.
And so after looking at so many NDEs, ultimately, you know, they talk about love and they talk about how it's the answer and that Earth is a school, also a playground. It's like a combination, you know, we're not here to suffer. But at the same time, it's often hard on purpose. And Vinny Tolman, who had an NDE, he actually had his as a bodybuilder. And in his NDE, he met a guide who taught him a lot. And one of the analogies he was telepathically taught is that Earth is almost like a gym. You know, we come here and in adversity and in experiences that challenge our egos, we have a chance to lift that weight and get stronger and more mature and more powerful. And in his experience, his guide actually turned out to be his, I think it was like his great grandfather or someone. And it isn't the only, experience like that. A lot of our guides and people who are helping us in spirit are actually loved ones from our past, which
they've lived before down here, and they know what's happening.
Exactly.
And what happens to you.
Could I pop in and just say, too,
absolutely.
That during life reviews, one of the things I love about NDE stories, I did not have a life review, but for example, Howard Storm, when he had his life review, he, of course, went to hell first and then gradually remembered to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And when he noticed, he said, God, all the demons moved away from him. And eventually he went toward heaven, in his case with Jesus. But when he had his life review, he thought he'd lived this fabulous life of becoming, you know, an artist and an art history professor and all of these fabulous things. And what he was shown was a time you were kind, you know, or a failure was times when you could have been kind and you weren't. And it's these little moments of choosing kindness where we build the muscle that Ned's talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, in his case, he talks about how, prior to his experience, he was so egotistical and even a bit mean towards
quite
people.
Mean.
And how a lot of people, when this happens and they return, it's almost like a awakening. It's a humbling, and you know, it's like, all right, I want to change, and I want to like apologize to everyone who I hurt. I don't want to repeat the patterns. And he actually, well, it's interesting because he talks about when he was on the other side, he talked to Jesus and I think like a council or a being who were kind of guiding him. And like a lot of people, when they're on the other side in that energy and beauty and power, they didn't want to come back, and they told him
not at all.
And so he argued, and he was arguing, and he said like, "You can't send me back because if I'm back there, I'll just make a fool of myself all over again." And they basically told him, "Look, Earth is hard. We know that. All you have to do is not repeat your mistakes. Mistakes are fine and they're even expected, but don't repeat them. That's it." And so, he basically learned, you know, and was told, you know, like all of us struggle and all of us fall down either because of our own choices or the choices of others. And as long as we think about it and we say, okay, I did that and the outcome it was unpleasant or I wasn't fulfilled, try something else. And as I say this, I think about even in my own life, a lot of us are on autopilot and we are just in lives that we are surviving and we're not really happy. We're not passionate or excited. We're just okay. If everything's just okay, it's a sign you could be happier. And what people learn is when we come here to Earth, the ideal is for us to be happy and to actually thrive. But it takes following and listening to our hearts more. And so, like, if you're in a job which is toxic, or a relationship which is also, if it's just okay and you're not feeling it, listen to your heart, because it's so important.
You can also train your heart to love more. You know, I often feel like the most valuable thing, if you look at my family, the alcoholism goes back generation after generation after generation, and the lack of parenting goes generation to generation. And that's why I felt so empty. But my son never seen me drunk, and I have been a better mother to him than my mother was to me. And that, I feel, is also a big win in the life purpose department.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, this has been a very interesting show. My goodness. And I, as I say, I have not ever heard of an experience quite like yours, Louisa. I've heard some pretty unusual ones, and that one I'm putting down as something that I've learned from. But, you know, we all have different ones. Let me finish up here. This is going to be, we're going to be on the air every Sunday. And if you are on the, it's 9 o'clock Pacific time. And this concludes our program tonight. And I want to thank you, Louisa Peck, and you, Ned Matania. And this is Diana White Eagle with Joseph Farley Presents.